Welcome to the Talking Poem Podcast. I'm your host, Charlie Green. On episodes like today's, I invite someone to bring in any poem they'd like to talk about for any reason. We'll talk about what excites us, what delights us, maybe what frustrates us, and we'll follow the poem in the conversation wherever they turn. After that, we'll have some silliness and a game. Today, I'm so happy to have as my guest, Maris Kreisman. Maris is an essayist and critic who writes a biweekly column at Lit Hub. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, New York Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times. I'm just going to stop right there, but it's a long, impressive list. She also has an essay collection coming out very soon from Echo called I Want to Burn This Place Down. Do you have a pub date on that?
All I know so far is summer of next year. So summer 25.
Awesome. And then also, if you can go back and listen to her excellent podcast, The Maris Review, or sign up for her Substack of the same name. Maris, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me here. What a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm really glad. So before we get to the poem, I want to talk a little bit about the essay you wrote about a month ago about the whole Pen America thing. So I thought it was really, really good. And there's not a need to rehash it necessarily. Just the brief summary is that they're trying to be political and apolitical at the same time, anti-banning books, but refuse to say anything about Israel, Palestine. And I'm just curious, I have not paid any attention to them. Has there been any development lately, or is it just sort of the same thing?
It's kind of just the same. They had their big gala, and it seemed to go off. You know, there were a couple of people protesting out front, but, you know, as the Museum of Natural History was huge, and we still need them, as I say in the essay, because, I mean, we are living in a time of unprecedented book banning. So, like, so much of what they do is important, and it just stinks to see them constantly blow it.
Yeah, and because you mentioned this, that they sort of do the thing, and my university does this too, where it's like, well, there are these attacks from the right and from the left, and it's like, you know, there's all those leftist states which are trying to ban books from libraries.
Mm-hmm,
oh, wait.
Wow.
Different. It's just very frustrating. I'm sure most people who listen are aware of it, but I'll link to the article, and they can get mad all the same at Pen America already. So let's get to the poem you chose, former guest Kim Adnitio's To the Woman Crying Uncontrollably in the Next Stall. I'll ask you to go ahead and read it, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay, here we go. To the Woman Crying Uncontrollably in the Next Stall. If you ever woke in your dress at 4 a.m., ever closed your legs to someone you loved, opened them for someone you didn't, moved against a pillow in the dark, stood miserably on a beach, seaweed clinging to your ankles, paid good money for a bad haircut, backed away from a mirror that wanted to kill you, bled into the back seat for lack of a tampon. If you swam across a river under rain, sang using a dildo for a microphone, stayed up to watch the moon eat the sun entire, ripped out the stitches in your heart because why not? If you think nothing and no one can, listen, I love you. Joy is coming.
Oh, thank you so much. This is a great poem. I love it so much. What's the main reason you wanted to talk about this one?
One is just, I love the poem so much. And I think it's really fascinating how some poetry goes viral. And I was so thrilled when this did. I went back and looked at the story about it, you know, that someone did encounter someone in the toilet stall next to them crying. And so they recited this poem to them. And that just seems like the most romantic use of poetry ever.
It's like, it doesn't really work if you go to Dover Beach and you recite Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach, you know, it's not romantic quite so much as it's corny.
No.
I feel like the answer is obvious in a way, but why do you think this poem went viral? And then we can talk about some other poems that have gone viral.
Yeah. Partly, I think it's a real post-Me Too kind of poem.
Maybe.
And I think there are so many conversations about what feminism should be today. And the idea that you can be strong and tough and also very vulnerable at the same time is lovely. And even just the idea that, like, it's okay to want romantic happiness or some other kind of personal fulfillment rather than just being concerned with the good of the world all the time.
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it. The there's a force to it too, that and this is true of a lot of her poems, which is one of the reasons I love her as a writer so much. But there's like the details are also specific, but there's also and just for listeners, there it's a sonnet, there's 14 lines, it's basically unrhymed except for the last couple lines, and there's no punctuation at all.
No punctuation.
Until the very last line, we get a slash between "no one can" and "listen, I love you, joy is coming." And so you have to read it. You have to sort of parse the syntax, but it's easy to parse in a way. Like
it is. I was nervous before reading it out loud for that very reason. And I think I only got caught once. So, yeah.
No, you didn't. Listeners won't hear anything like that.
Okay.
So, and it's also the details are so specific. Yeah. And they're like, I always, you know, talking with students about specific details, but these are so fantastically particular. Saying using a dildo for a microphone. It doesn't quite evoke the sort of standard scene in a romantic comedy where women are dancing around in their pajamas singing into.
That's usually a hairbrush. Right?
Yeah, it's usually a hairbrush. The dildo is a better prop in this scene.
Absolutely.
But she's just, and there's also these great moments in it, the paid good money for a bad haircut. Like, it's not all terror, but it's also there's
exactly.
This sense of politeness that's going on, you know, that you can't say this is a bad haircut, fix this. There's also the sense of, you know, romance, and then just the, you know, so the basic facts of being a woman led into the backseat for lack of a tampon, you know. So I think that's a lot of it. I did notice, so I think part of the reason that it went viral, and I may be wrong about this, I've not done math on this. This is just my sense. My feeling, though, is that many or most of the poems that go viral are by cis female writers, or at least in the circle. Yeah. I'm curious your sense why that is.
I will say, and this isn't entirely an answer to your question, but one of the reasons I felt so strongly about this poem is because during lockdown, the collection that this poem was in, Now We're Getting Somewhere, was published. And at the time, I was doing events for the bookstore McMally Jackson. And so I got to like see her on a Zoom and enjoy her presence. And I do think that the pandemic time was a time when poetry was ready to go viral. I think that's like, I think we were really all looking for something resonant. And I think we were all looking at our phones too much. And it's nice to remember to take a breath and stop scrolling for a second.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I mean, obviously there are plenty of poets by male writers shared, but like, off the top of your head, what are the viral poems?
Yeah, it's Maggie Smith. It's Ada Limón. What is the name of that poem about the new season? And then there are some other. Well, I think the closest we've come to, or I've seen to a man going viral, is Ukrainian poet Ilya Kaminsky.
Right. Yeah. The something during the war.
Yeah. We lived something.
We lived happily during the war.
Happily during the war. It's kind of, I'm trying to think, like, I can't actually tell you, except that I suppose women are mostly the people on these sites like Instagram, where we are looking to our phones for some level of spirituality.
I wonder if that's part of it. Like, part of it is that it may be, Instagram may be more engaging to women in that way than it is for men who are just looking for sports highlights. That's on the clean end of the spectrum, probably, for a lot of straight men anyway. But I feel like because there's also Mary Oliver, who I love, and I've been kind of, there was something on Twitter a couple weeks ago where somebody called her overrated, and then a million people reacted angrily, as happens. But what I found is that the Ada Limón, I've been trying to avoid saying this. I'm not crazy about her poems. I don't think she's a bad poet. They don't resonate with me in a way. I always find myself wanting the poem to do something more. I've discovered from talking to friends that I'm not alone in this, but it's not like there's not like a huge contingent of anti-Ada Limón people. And there's probably some extent to which it's like everybody loves her. So my oppositional defiant self is going to go a little crazy. But I found that when with viral poems, if there's a poem I don't like or something I don't like in it, every time I see it, I get a little more angry.
Sure.
Which is totally not fair to the poem. Are there any poems like that for you where you see it and you just get annoyed and frustrated? Or do you feel...
I feel like this is almost a two on the nose easy answer, but I'm going to give it anyway, which is, you know, most of Ruby Kaur's work that has gone very viral.
Yeah.
And again, I think it's wonderful if people are finding beauty in it. And I guess the problem is, and probably you experience this too very much, is that when something goes viral, there are maybe like three or four of these kinds of poems. And you just want to be like, wait, there's an entire world out there. Like, if you like that, you're going to be blown away by this, this, and this. And we rarely get a chance to widen the net.
Yeah, I think that's part of it too, is I want it to be an entry point to other poems. Like you see a poem you like and you, oh, let me see more by this writer. And then it's like other writers. And that's probably a large part of it too. Because it is, poetry is not doing badly right now, I feel like. And I think that the internet has helped. Like when I was an undergrad, if you wanted to buy books of poetry, you had to get a print catalog from a specific bookstore, like in New England, and, you know, like put a little slip of paper into an envelope along with a check. And so now the access is so much easier, which I think is great and really is helping and useful. I also feel like there's a commonality among these poems. The thing that started bothering me about Mary Oliver, who I love, it's just, it starts to feel a little like all the poems build up to a kind of uplift.
Mm-hmm.
And at times it feels mechanical. Like that's, if you do the same thing every time, it can start to feel mechanical. And I feel that about Ada Limón's poems. I want to reiterate for anyone who is like fashioning a stake to plunge into my heart, I don't think she's a bad poet. I just, for whatever reason, her poems just don't hit with me. Maris is pulling out a gun. You can't gun through Zoom.
I will say that I really loved her last collection. Again, for a similar reason, I suppose, to this kind of Kimada Nitya poem, which was that it was during lockdown and being able to follow what she chose to focus on in lockdown with and in nature the nature that was accessible to her from her home really spoke to me. I also think she has a very, very cute pug.
Cute animals redeem all, which, by the way, I guess this would be a good time to mention Busy, Maris's dog, who you should... Does Busy have his own Instagram?
She does, but it's... Oh, listen, we don't know how she identifies, but... She does, but I've been bad at updating it lately.
Oh, she's adorably... She's a dog a lot of people would call an ugly dog because of the breed, but she's adorable. You know, they have the smushed face and the... You know, the breathing issues, and I think some people are turned off by that. I think she's adorable.
She's very adorable.
I mean, all dogs are adorable.
All dogs are good. I think I would go that far.
Anyway, we've gotten way off. I want to come back to it. Part of what I want to talk about, just a couple of things I like, and then I'm curious to hear you talk about a little bit more too. Part of it is just there's so much in it. There's so many situations and scenes, and they're all so compressed so tightly that it feels like there's an entire world in the poem, which is all the more impressive because it's sort of set in this moment, in this private space, in the bathroom. And to have that much, and so when it gets to the last line, "Listen, I love you, joy is coming," that feels so genuine in that moment.
So the title is immediately relatable, I think. Many of us have been in that situation when, for whatever reason, we are in that stall crying. And the reasons that are mentioned in the poem may or may not be the reasons why you felt this way. But the reassurance at the end You're right, because Mary Oliver does feel a little uplifty, but this like kind of punches you in the face with its upliftingness, you know? Like it just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And that is kind of life affirming.
Yeah, I feel like it's because it's intimacy between strangers too.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mary, I have to emphasize, I love Mary Oliver's poems. There are a couple of them. And this is the problem with viral poems, is like I'm picking on stuff because I see them so often.
Right, right.
And it's the sort of thing where if I could single white female Mary Oliver, I would. But at times there's a kind of, it's spoken out like sage wisdom. There's the you is sort of the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, I think at times it feels like you're being sort of uplifted but talked down to at the same time. This poem, it feels like there's such a genuine knowing the situation while not knowing the person. And so the intimacy and speaking to a stranger feels just like such a different kind of connection between speaker and person in the bathroom.
I know this is, I'm just going to say it. It really does remind me of the Seinfeld episode, Can You Spare a Square? But it has like a happier, more communal ending. Like, yes, you can spare a square, according to Kim Meneanitzio.
Yeah, you can spare even more than that.
Yeah.
Thankfully. Well, part of it is like there's this, it could easily be a poem of like a list of entirely awful situations, but we get the sort of turn to swim across a river under a rain. Like there are these situations with the potential for joy. And so it starts to turn toward that without her calling that. And then ripped out the stitches in your own heart feels complicated. Like it feels like there can be joy in that, taking that action. But it's a more complex kind of thing than either what feels like a lot of discomfort and suffering, even in the opening, in the first eight lines. And
yeah.
So there is that move towards, listen, I love you, joy is coming. So it's not totally out of nowhere. It's been set up in a way, but it's so explicit, though.
Yes.
You know, nowhere else in the poem do we get any kind of explicit naming of emotion that way, which is amazing to me how good this poem. I love the poem. I say this sometimes when I'm teaching. Sometimes I just want to like point to a poem and say, yeah, it's great. And not have a ton to say of articulate things to say about it. Do you have like favorite moments, favorite lines or phrases in it?
The Dildo line really spoke to me. And I guess you're right. Like that is a joyful moment that she is bringing up, and the haircut too, like the idea that these tiny little things in life can kind of add up.
Mm-hmm.
And you might be crying about any number of things, including that.
Yeah, I like that there's sometimes it's the one thing, sometimes it's the accumulation.
Yeah,
which sometimes are big and then sometimes are smaller, you know. And that we get like the bad haircut, the mirror that wanted to kill you. Like there's just, you know, sometimes it is this grand, enormous thing. The dildo line I like in part because it's funny, and that she's a very funny writer. She's very, has a great sense of humor, and all of her poems feel very down to earth to
yes.
me.
Even I think that's why I was so thrilled to host her for McNally Jackson. Like she just seems like, oh yes, this is someone that I want to talk to. That I believe has the answers. Like I believe that her poetry and her persona are entwined, and mm-hmm. I am waiting for that guidance.
Yeah. Some people write about like creative nonfiction that when an essay sounds, the essays are the best when it sounds really like that person speaking, and her poems, which is really hard to do with poems because there's a tendency, I think, as somebody who writes a lot of bad poetry, there's a tendency to sound like you're writing poetry even. And you know, this is a beautiful poem, but it feels so down to earth.
Yes.
And I was delighted that I got to record with her because I did not know her. And emailed her thinking, I emailed a bunch of people thinking none of them will respond. And she immediately responded. And it was an absolute delight. She's just totally great person. Told an amazing story. She once burned an effigy of the book critic William Logan, who is the basically best known for writing sort of hatchet job reviews of books of poetry. And I don't know, that that made me admire her almost as much as anything. She had done it at a writer's conference. So,
oh,
you know,
even better.
Yeah. So any other things you wanted to say or mention about the poem? I'm trying to look through my notes, but the printer seems to be out of ink. And so I'm like squinting at little things. Because I think I've said a lot of what I want to say. Do you have other things you wanted to mention or draw my attention to? Or
I think we've touched on this, but I do think that the lack of punctuation is so propulsive that mm-hmm. it kind of, you know, I think when you're reading it to yourself, you have to start parsing. And at least for me, I then really wanted to speak the poem out, read the poem out loud, just to help myself kind of figure out where the breaks are. And I think that's a really cool trick.
Yeah, because there are only two lines that don't break mid-sentence at the end.
Yeah.
One is, if you swam across a river, you know, which is basically sort of where we get the turn in the poem, and then stayed up to watch the moon eat the sun entire. But it also creates the, you know, entire ribbed out, like you get things put together that other we wouldn't necessarily see as together in the same way. So I love the poem. Really glad you brought it in. Are you ready to turn to the silliness part?
Yes, please.
So before we get to the game, as always, we have an ad. Maris, have you invested in cryptocurrency?
I have not.
Probably a good sign. I've noticed that very few poets invest in crypto. I think it just hasn't been marketed to them the right way.
Yeah.
Yes. That's changing right now because there are finally crypto coins and tokens for poets. Join cryptocurrency. You can invest your money, if as poets you have any, in such klepto as Witcoin, the Walt Whitman-based coin. You can trust it'll last because once Witcoin starts, it just keeps on going. Or if that's not your flavor and you like fascism, try the Ezra Pound. You can invest in the Marianne Moore, the cryptocurrency that will only go up forevermore. Or maybe you want to start small, so start with the Alfred Lord Pennyson. We do recommend avoiding the Robert Lowell, as it's always going down. But maybe you want something else. How about Emily Dickinson NFTs? Unlike NFTs, these only go up in value. You probably heard of the Bored Apes, but you can buy Russell Edson's ape. It stuffs your wallet with money just like you like it. That's cryptocurrency, because to quote T.S. Eliot, good writers borrow, great writers steal. Okay, so 99% of the reason that the podcast exists is so I can inflict the puns on the world instead of my wife.
Beautiful.
So, all right, on to the game. I assume you're familiar, Maris, with the New York Yankees legend, Roger Maris, because you should.
Yes.
What do you know about Roger Maris?
I know that he was the home run. I don't know that much about baseball, truly. But I do know that he had a record for home runs until very recently, until like 5 years ago, I think.
It's more like 20 years ago now, I think.
So I'm just old now.
We're all old. Like when you said 5 years for a split second, I thought, yeah, it was really recent. And then I thought about it. I was like, no, it was longer than that. So he broke the home run record for single season. He hit 61 home runs, was hated for it. Yankee fans hated him because even though he was a Yankee, he was breaking Babe Ruth's record. But he hit 61 home runs in 1961. So today we are playing a game that I'm calling, but this has nothing to do with baseball. I'm going to ask you
good.
Five questions about events related to literature in 1961.
Listen.
Highly specific. So I jumped from Maris to 1961. Any questions?
No, this sounds good.
All right. Maris Kreisman, are you ready to play? But this has nothing to do with baseball.
I am.
All right. Number one, in January 1961, a divorce was granted in Mexico to Marilyn Monroe and what playwright?
Arthur Miller.
That is correct. Bonus question, spell playwright.
P-L-A-Y-W-R-I-G-H-T. Playwright.
Yeah, you get the bonus point. My spelling has gone way downhill ever since I did editing work, because you kind of stop trusting yourself to get words right because you don't want to make a mistake. And now I can't spell anymore. And also mid-40s, and so I actually I was spelling my wife's name on the phone and misspelled it. And she was in earshot. And so now I'm deeply embarrassed. Anyway, number two, in November 61, a major satire of World War II is published and added a phrase to the English language about a no-win situation. What was the novel?
Catch 22.
Yes, the questions do get a little more difficult as we go, by the way. Bonus question, what was the original title?
Oh, I don't think I'm going to know it.
It was Catch 18. Yeah, and the reason behind changing it is there was a novel that had come out, and I've forgotten by who, but it was like something 18. And so his editor, Robert Gottlieb, said it can't be 18.
Sure. And
apparently it was 18. I'm quoting Wikipedia here just for the sake of time. The implications of in Judaism of the number 18, which refers to remaining alive, were relevant to his Heller's somewhat greater emphasis on Jewish themes in early drafts of the novel. And so he would spend, according to his daughter, Emily Heller, they would spend nights around the dinner table like, what about like Catch 29 or Catch 357? And it's like eventually they landed on it.
And 22 had the right ring to it.
Exactly. And it had no significance. It was essential that it would be a number with like no significance of any kind. So number three, in May, Grove Press published a novel by Henry Miller 27 years after it was published in France. In 1964, the Supreme Court ruled that the novel was not obscene. What is that Henry Miller novel?
Tropic of.
Yeah, this is the trick.
I got there. Let's try Cancer.
That's it. Yes. It
okay.
Bonus question. What was the original title of Tropic of Cancer?
Ooh, I think you're going to have to enlighten me again.
Crazy Cock.
That's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. He chose Tropic of Cancer eventually because the literal association with the disease cancer, not the Tropic of Cancer in any way. All right. In March 1961, the Shakespeare Memorial Theater in Stratford-upon-Avon changed its name to what, which is still its name today. And I can give you a hint if necessary.
The Globe.
The hint here is think about Kansas City's Major League Baseball team, if you know them.
That's not going to help.
It's the Royal Shakespeare Theater.
Oh, the Royal Shakespeare. Right. Okay.
Yeah, the Globe is in London, I think. Now that I say that, I'm worried I'm wrong. But bonus question, spell theater as it's spelled in the theater's name.
T-H-E-A-T-R-E.
Yes, that is correct. That's the sort of spelling that makes me think about the great tweet where there's the basic joke. I'm going to have to link to this. I'm mad at myself that I can't remember it, but it's like, hey, Jeff, do you want to go to a game? And there's G-A-E-F-F. It says, yes. And then G-E-O-F-F. It's yeehaws.
Yeah.
All right. Final question. In 1961, the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction was awarded to what novel that is now a staple of high school classrooms all across the country?
Yeah. 1961.
I can give you a hint if necessary.
Let's try 1984.
I'll give you the hint.
Boo. Okay. Boo?
Boo.
Oh, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes, it is To Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah.
Thank you.
I asked that mainly because I want to ask this bonus question. What was the estimated first print run of the novel?
That's such a good question because to go back and think about what their expectations were for this work. And that's when people used to buy books. So.
Yeah. Yeah. What are low expectations in a time when there's no internet?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to go with 20,000.
They did not expect it to sell well. And so the original print run is estimated 5,000 copies.
Damn.
So 5,000 copies was a low expectation. So, and of course, it has now sold millions of copies, obviously. There was some British outlet. It's not The Guardian. It's something like The Guardian, but my brain is like a sieve at this point. There was some British news outlet that said that's the work of literature that everybody had to read. And they very explicitly and deliberately said it was even more important than the Bible, which I feel like that's a big claim. You've done very well on this quiz, Maris. Thank you so much for being
here.
Thank you. I'm really, really grateful. Anything you'd like to say or plug before we go?
Yeah, I am a writer who's struggling to find many outlets to write for. So I have a Substack. And so my Substack is just mariskreisman.com or the Maris Review. Little pun.
Yep.
That we like.
And you've got the essay collection coming out sometime summer of next year.
sometime summer of next year.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And since I just found out last week, I have my first novel coming out next year. So
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very delighted. This is a joke. I have a reason to live. That's a joke. I want to make.
When do you know? Do you have a pub date?
February. February 1st is what they said. Yeah, it's a very quick turnaround. It's small press. I did not think this would ever get published. It's very silly. It's an Iraq war satire. I'd never self-promote on this podcast, so this is the most self-promotion I've ever done.
I love this. What press?
Gold Wake Press. They are based at a university. Published a bunch of writers I really like. Bess Winter, Kelly McGee, Robin Henley. Anyway.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's very exciting. So thanks, everybody, for listening. As always, have a great day. Read some poems, pet some dogs, and support striking workers wherever you find them. Bye.